Somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout, but there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck!
I only got one thing to say to you. Strike this mother out.
He got a perfect game and one done by the King.
Hey, you! How you like them apples?
Took away a game-tying home run for Manny Ramirez.
That's my thing, fellas.
We will see you tomorrow night.
Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for visiting us this evening.
Who is this douchebag with a saxophone in Philly? That's not like a Philly thing.
Just behind the curtain, while we're recording here, the Eagles-Packers game is starting, and there's a guy playing the national anthem on a saxophone and really getting into it, if you ask me.
It was a little much. They should have had Bob Dylan.
Yeah, they should have had. I'm sure Bob Dylan would love to have his first televised performance in 30 years and playing the saxophone before an NFL game.
If I know two things about Bob Dylan, it's one, the National Football League, and two, saxophones. So I think he would love to do that.
Exactly. And the National Anthem.
The National Anthem.
And the National The big three. Yeah.
These are all things that he would be interested in taking part in.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Mudville, episode number 63. It's been a little while, but we are back. I am one of your hosts, Nolan Rabine.
I'm your other host, Brody Staub.
And we've got one of our favorite guests returning to the pod today. It is Bob Dylan himself. Bob, how are you?
Hey, how's it going? I heard you guys were doing a little podcast. Wow, that sucks. I was going to try to do the whole podcast.
It was not nearly as good. No, I could. If you want me to do it, I could do it.
That was pretty good, considering that I just totally put you on the spot. No, he's back. You know him. You love him. It's Morgan. Longtime listeners need no introduction. We've got a really nice episode for you guys today. We're going to talk about a bunch of free agent signings and a couple trades that we haven't gotten the chance to go through yet. And we're talking about the new James Mangold movie, A Complete Unknown, the biopic of one of our favorite artists, Bob Dylan, speaking of needing no introduction. And we got Morg back on the pod because I feel like he has sort of had an interesting journey with this film, sort of conceptually. I know you were very, very against it when this was announced, and it was announced that Timothy Chalamet was going to be portraying Bob Dylan, but you did a full 180. You didn't let any preconceived notions of what this movie was going to be affect your judgment of the film, and I was very, very surprised to see you drop a 5-star rating on it. So we are going to get into all of that, but before we do, happy wild card weekend. Go Bills. We haven't had any interesting football to be played over the weekend. I would have talked about it a little bit here in the intro if we did, but three real blowouts starting out the weekend.
So far, including the college games. I mean, there's just nothing. It hasn't been as exciting as wild card weekend normally is yet. But I do think this Eagles-Packer game that is starting in a few minutes.
Go Pack Go is what
go
I have
pack,
to say.
Go Pack Go.
Not really.
I'm rooting for the green team.
Not really the most fascinating weekend of football so far, but I was heartened to see the rest of the world finally coming around on my calm down on the Justin Herbert talk opinion, which, like, he's a very talented player, but the way that these NFL media people talk about him, you would think he was Patrick Mahomes, so it was nice for people to finally be like, okay, maybe we should temper expectations a little bit for this guy who has never won a big game and can't seem to perform well in them. So, that was nice to see. Nothing personal against the guy. I just think we need to all calm down.
You know who he is? He's Philip Rivers.
Well, I like him more than Philip Rivers, which is a low bar.
You like everybody more than Philip Rivers.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting couple weeks here in terms of football. You know, I'm a college guy. I've enjoyed the bowl games. I've enjoyed the Penn State Notre Dame game specifically was great. But other than that, the playoff games have been blowouts. It's been fun. Baseball offseason in full swing, and ready to launch right into that if you are. The weird thing I think we got to talk about, fellas, is what's going on with the Baltimore Orioles letting Corbin Burns go?
They're doing nothing.
Yeah.
Just doing nothing.
They have a plan.
Nolan and I touched on this last week, I think, and I thought that they would have done something by the next time we recorded. They still have done nothing.
So I saw a report a couple weeks ago. It was from Pitcher List. Nick Pollock from Pitcher List said that Rubenstein, I don't know quite if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. It's Isaiah Hartenstein all over again. I think it's Hartenstein, but Rubenstein. So just
sure. Magna Carta owner. Yeah,
absolutely. Magna Carta owner. Apparently he gave Mike Elias in the Orioles front office like the green light to go ahead and spend more money and get out of that like bottom three of league payroll or wherever they've been at. Mike Elias has been so hesitant to do so, has not gone out there and made any splashes. I mean, this is all speculation. I don't know exactly how true it is, but you know, given some certain developments over the past couple weeks, I mean, I think maybe Rubes is just a little bit too preoccupied with receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom for his many financial crimes to go out and actually pay ample attention to the Major League Baseball team he owns, which resulted in Corbin Burnes signing a 6-year, $210 million contract with the Arizona Diamondbacks, while his hometown Baltimore Orioles got Charlie Morton, the 48-year-old pitcher, on a 1-year, $15 million deal, which we'll see how that goes. But no, he's 41. I was 41. Exaggerating.
I thought he was 53.
Oh. Yeah. He's actually 67.
A couple of things about Charlie Morton. First of all, I think whenever you can add a steakhouse / salt empire heir to your team, it's a really good sign. When I saw Charlie Morton pitching for the Pirates like years ago, you would never have convinced me this guy was going to stick around until he was 41, so good for him. But it is kind of weird that the Orioles, I think their biggest headlines so far this offseason have been signing Charlie Morton and then their deal falling through with Jeff Hoffman, who is obviously the Phillies reliever who ended up going to the Blue Jays, if I recall correctly.
Yes, the Blue Jays. They also gave Tyler O'Neill $17 million a year.
So the Orioles, you see this in a lot of sports where a team just gets crowned, you know, and it's like, oh, well, you know, they're going to start winning. This is the new team. Everyone's got to be afraid of them. And then maybe that team kind of gets high on their own supply, starts believing they have enough in the room to win. And maybe sometimes that's true. But with this team specifically, I really think that they're going to feel the loss of Burnes, considering that rotation's looking a little thin without him. And, I mean, like you said, I think Rubenstein supposedly came in there to spend money. Like I alluded to earlier, he literally owns the Magna Carta, the document. So you would think this is a guy who would go there like Steve Cohen and just start throwing bills around. But, you know, not everyone does that. So, I mean, who knows? But as a Yankee fan, I'm a little relieved to see Corbin Burnes out of the division. But as a baseball observer, I'm a little confused by what their plan is.
I'm very confused, especially because the American League, as the conversation around the Yankees has been all season, is very weak. So if you're the Orioles, you should want to be able to compete. It wouldn't take that much in the AL. The only team that you really have to worry about is the Yankees. So if you're going to rely on this young core, I would think that you're going to need something else. And I get not being in love with the free agents who are out there right now, but I mean, I don't think Anthony Santander is going to be, you know, super expensive at this point. This is really late in the offseason. He'll probably be more willing to take something. If you want to bring him back, you could probably do that. I mean, Jack Flaherty could probably be had for relatively cheap. He's a good pitcher. Ha-Seong Kim feels like he could fit in on this team maybe somewhere. I don't know. Like, there's options still. There's still a lot of pitching. Like, Tanner Scott still hasn't signed if they want to go after that in the bullpen. There's options. So fully freaking out time, but they need to do something soon.
Yeah, they also, I forgot to mention, obviously the biggest splash of the offseason, they signed Andrew Kittredge to a 1-year, $10 million deal. So,
no, Andrew Kittredge got even signed.
Yeah, sorry about that. I mean, obviously, as we know, the biggest 1-2 punch news of the hot stove season has been Juan Soto and Andrew Kittredge. So my bad for failing to mention that.
That's true. Oh, they also signed Gary Sanchez, by the way.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Thank God.
Okay, so $3.5 million.
Yeah, they're loading up. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, there you go.
The replacement for old James McCann. I mean, I think from the start of the offseason, I kind of felt like the Orioles didn't have a great chance of re-signing Corbin Burnes. Like, obviously, they have more than enough payroll to make a deal like that happen, but I felt like, you know, maybe the market for him would just be too strong. There would be too many contenders if Steve Cohen and fucking Hal Steinbrenner, Dodgers, whoever else are out there after you. I mean, it seemed like it might just be a little bit of a daunting competition for the Orioles to actually win. But then he goes and he signs with the Arizona Diamondbacks, which I think that is incredibly interesting. You know, I will talk about the Diamondbacks in a second, but it does leave the Orioles rotation very much lacking right now with Zach Eflin. Grayson Rodriguez is really going to be the key for their rotation's success, I think, not just in 2025, but moving forward. You know, if they don't bring in any other big name free agents or go out and trade for a guy like the Red Sox did this offseason with Garrett Crochet, because I don't really see any other guys coming up in the Orioles system pitching wise that are going to make a significant impact on this rotation. So while I felt like they were probably going to lose Corbin Burns to a big name team like the Mets or the Dodgers, I did anticipate them going after some of the lower tier options in free agency. I believe I predicted a trio of left-handed arms going to them in the offseason with Sean Manaea, who has since re-signed with the Mets. We'll get to that in a second. It might have been Max Fried even, who of course went to the Yankees. We touched on that two episodes ago. Yusei Kikuchi, who signed with the Angels. And I think that was it. But, I mean, they haven't gone out and signed any of these guys. Instead, they get 41-year-old Charlie Morton on a one-year deal who projects to be like a 3-4 starter on this team. Probably will give you like a 4.20 ERA, something like that.
They also signed a 35-year-old starter out of Japan.
I was going to touch on that as well.
I had no idea that even happened.
Sugano, I don't really think has a ton of upside. I mean, it seems like
Yuki Sugano.
Yeah, he's not a big strikeout guy. He walks good amount of hitters. He's not a pitcher, truth be told, that I know a ton about. You know, he wasn't one of the Japanese careers that I paid really any attention to. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this rotation shakes out. Like, I think that a healthy Grayson is going to make a big leap, and I think you can get ace production out of him at some point. Turned 25 recently, so
Sugano is a career 2.45 ERA in the NPB.
Okay.
Okay.
You know, maybe he'll make something happen. But speaking of NPB,
about 150 innings a season.
Roky Sasaki has not signed either. So if I was the Orioles, I would be very, very in on him. But I don't really think they have too much of a chance in those sweepstakes. I'm still pretty locked into the idea that he's going to be headed to the Dodgers like everybody else seems to be. But yeah, it does really feel like a missed opportunity for the O's because, like you said, Morg, the American League is totally wide open right now. You know, the Yankees lost Juan Soto and went out pivoting to get Cody Bellinger, Max Fried, Devin Williams. Oh, that was you. My bad, Brody. Pivoted, they got like three different...
Morgan's smart enough, you don't need to give him undue credit.
Fair enough.
Yeah, you do.
Three all-stars as replacements, and while I don't think that it gives them like a particularly elite roster, like it gives them a good amount of depth when you add that to what they had already, which was a very flawed team with some incredibly talented players. You do get the sense that they're probably still American League favorites, you know, particularly because the Astros just traded away Kyle Tucker, and it doesn't really seem like there are any other teams in the American League that are looking to take up that mantle. I think maybe the Red Sox will be there in like 2026 or 27, but I'd be very surprised if it happened next year.
I wouldn't be shocked if the Red Sox were good this coming season.
I think they'll be good. I don't think that they'll contend for the American League crown in 2025. I think that the number of rookie hitters who struggled last year has me thinking that the gap between the minors is wider than ever. So it just makes me want to give young hitters making their debut a longer grace period with how long they're allowed to struggle before we start making any grand statements about their future. Jackson Holliday looked so bad. I mean, Wyatt Langford needed a full season to show flashes of the hitter that I expect him to be this upcoming season and beyond. Colt Keith sort of the same way. He tore up the minor leagues his whole career, and he looked awful for the first couple months before evening back out, regressing a little bit more to the mean, and then showing, you know, what I think his career is going to look like too. So I think while we had a lot of rookie superstar performances in 2023 with Corbin Carroll and Gunnar Henderson, I think it led expectations for some of these players last year to do the same thing. And that didn't really happen. Like, if you told me that Luis Gil was going to win Rookie of the Year at this time last year, I would have said you were insane, because it seemed like there were so many options and so many guys who were going to contend for that award. And then none of them really did. So the reason I say all that is that the two guys that I think are most hyped to enter the league in 2025 in terms of like offensive players are both on the Red Sox, with Roman Anthony and last year's pop-up Christian Campbell, not to mention Marcelo Meyer, who's been kicking around in the minors for I think as long as Jason Dominguez. So if you want to talk about prospect fatigue with a 21-year-old Dominguez, you got to do it with a 22-year-old Marcelo Meyer too.
His name is been thrown around forever. So long.
You know, the Red Sox have this core that they're going to build, and they're going to be so good. They did, yeah. Well, they needed to. They took advantage of those last two draft picks, Kyle Teal, Braden Montgomery, packaged them for Garrett Crochet to get the ace that they so badly needed. I think if you're a Sox fan, you kind of have to expect some of this, like, throw them into the fire and watch what happens. But you're also going to have a lot of patience with three rookie hitters who are projected to be in the lineup this year. I mean, maybe they just hit the ground running. Maybe you have a couple of true superstars on that roster. But, you know,
it's easy to hit there.
Yeah, it certainly is. But I think you have to give them a year to sort of develop a bit. Yeah. And that's kind of why I think maybe the Red Sox won't be elite contenders in the American League in 2025 in a vacuum. But the Orioles absolutely had the chance to be in that conversation, and they really didn't do it. And it's incredibly surprising to me that seems like the opportunity is right there, and that it would be so easy to go out and just, even with a league average payroll, they would be at worst the second best team in the American League next year. You know, maybe even the best. Right. I think they were my pick to win the American League last year, I believe. So the talent is there, but they haven't brought in any free agents. They've made a couple trades, but they've lost the guys that they've traded for in free agency. And worst of all, maybe, they have not extended any of their young talent. Like, where's the extension for Gunnar Henderson? Where's the extension for Adley Rutschman? I mean, Holiday might be a different story because he comes from a baseball family, and Matt Holiday made so many millions in his career, you know, just a little bit of a different situation. But
they might be hesitant with Holiday because of, you know, his struggles in the first season.
Yeah, I get that.
When we talked about Burns, we also talked about, you know, the team that did end up signing him, which was the Arizona Diamondbacks. And I think that's kind of a fascinating team to look at right now. So I could touch on that. Ken Kendrick, the owner, who, you know, you got to give him credit. This is a guy usually devoted to wasting money on, like, horrible projects, like, for instance, the West Virginia Mountaineers football coaching search and the presidential campaign of Tim Scott. Those are, like, his biggest investments. So this is probably, the Arizona Diamondbacks are probably his most successful baby. But this rotation now, Burns, you have Gallen, Merrill Kelly as your top three, which is right there with a lot of teams. You have Eduardo Rodriguez and Brandon Pfaadt in the back end. So that bumps Jordan Montgomery to the bullpen, I would guess. And obviously, we've all heard the stories of Jordan Montgomery and buyer's remorse coming from the Diamondbacks and Montgomery himself. So you would think this is a situation that's not tenable. Now, at this point, you got a guy like Montgomery who, a couple of years ago, was a World Series hero. And this year is projected to be like a swingman in that bullpen. It's a huge fall from grace. And I just think this situation might not be able to last for much longer. You know, like, the center cannot hold here. So what are they going to do with Montgomery? Will anyone take him off their hands?
He's 32. So you would think that they probably could get something for him if they wanted to move on. And, you know, I don't think that his value is completely tanked. As you said, he was a World Series hero. You know,
the problem is the $23 million salary for this year.
Yeah, but that's not that much compared to other. I mean, like, if you think that you could get, I mean, the best that Montgomery could be for you is probably like a three, maybe a two starter in a lower end rotation. So, I mean, like, there's teams who would probably bite on that. If you're the Orioles, Jordan Montgomery slots in as your second starter. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's not a bad place to look. Where is he from? because he might
originally he's from the he's from the South. He's from South Carolina, I think.
So maybe he wants to go home. I don't know. He's from South Carolina.
He wants to go play in South Carolina. Yeah,
sure, probably. Why not? No, but, Atlanta. But like that's not a bad thought. He could end up on the Braves. Like there's
he was so dreadful last year, and
I mean, he was. I don't think he wanted to be out there though. And he seems like somebody who's not really he's not going to truck through any discomfort. I guess.
Well, the other thing you could chuck that up to is maybe the idea of obviously he missed all of spring training and signed so late. But, I mean, really, it just makes you wonder where he's going. And that was kind of my larger point about the Diamondbacks is, do they have a plan or are they just signing guys when they become available? Because Burns obviously would fit in to any team, so that's a good idea. But this is a team, obviously, in the World Series 2 years ago. And now, where are they going from here? Because you have Drew Jones hovering around the minors and probably not going to fulfill his potential. And it's like, where are we going from here, fellas?
Well, we should also talk about the fact that they acquired Josh Naylor. I get you're losing out on Christian Walker, so you need to replace him. Sure. I just don't know if that's the most – I don't know. I'm surprised that Cleveland got rid of him. They also got rid of Andrés Giménez. Like that's we could talk about them too because they're kind of interesting right now.
Shitting payroll. But, that's what they always do.
I know, but it's still – I mean, they looked like a team that was close to competing, and now they're just tearing it down again without getting that close, I guess. I don't know. The Diamondbacks have been a good team for a few years here, so you'd expect them to make a few more moves than just around the edges. But their rotation right now is Burns, Gallen, Kelly, Eduardo Rodriguez, Brandon Pfaadt, Jordan Montgomery. That's the list, which is six guys, if you can count. And it's good. That's a really good six guys. Their lineup is decent. It's top-heavy for sure. There's some guys at the bottom who you want more out of, but, I mean, Gabe Moreno, if he gives you a better season, he's still young, so that, that helps there. And if you have a catcher who can hit, that obviously really helps you. They move on from Jock Peterson. They move on from Randall Grichuk. I don't know. They get rid of some older guys. It's not there yet. This team did make the World Series with, I think, less talent than they have right now. So I guess you can be excited about that. But I don't know. It's interesting. I think this team could go anywhere from 70 wins to 95. it's just gonna depend on how the offense looks with just some new pieces here and there. But the rotation is good enough to win you a lot of games.
Morgan, you said something interesting about sort of not knowing how long this rotation would be able to stick together, how soon it might be before everything sort of crumbled and fell apart. And that's why I think that this Corbin Burns signing is so important for the Arizona Diamondbacks. I mean, it goes without saying, this is not the team that I expected to sign him. The thing you're talking about with Jordan Montgomery being from the South, wanting to play, around his hometown, absolutely is the case with Corbin Burns, and that's kind of why I think maybe the Orioles felt like they didn't have as good of a chance to sign him, as he lives in the West Coast. I think he might even live in Arizona, which might have given the Arizona Diamondbacks a huge advantage in his free agency sweepstakes, but
likely place for him to be.
Yeah. Adding him to this rotation really does a lot of good, I think, for the other pitchers in it. It takes a lot of pressure off of Gallen to be a true ace for this team. I mean, we saw how much they relied on him all throughout the 2023 postseason and into the World Series. Looked super gassed last year. I think that was a lot of the reason why he had kind of a down year. There has been a bit of regression from Gallen over the past few seasons, but I do think that this is a guy who the stuff is good enough, and he's still on the right side of 30 for another year. So I think he really is just more of a two than a one. And, adding a guy like Burns who can go out and throw 200 innings this year, if he goes out and does that, that takes so much pressure off of Gallen and allows him to fit into a role where I think he's more suited. And it also allows the same thing for Merrill Kelly, who is more of a three than he is a two. Kelly made the start of his life in the World Series. That was so huge for his career, but he's not a guy that I think is going to go out there and do that for an entire season. He only threw 73 innings last year. He suffered injuries, which, might have also been a result of that extra work that he had to go through in October. Those two guys in particular both threw so many extra innings that I don't think they were expecting to have to throw, that, you know, just being able to add this guy and have them be the 2-3 in a rotation instead of a 1-2, especially in such a talented division where you're going up against the Dodgers, up against the Padres. Not only is it great for the other pitchers in that rotation, but it's also good that it signals that Arizona is still going to try and contend, you know, even going up against the super team Dodgers, the talented Padres, the Giants trying to make something happen, and then just the absolute clown show, the Colorado Rockies. But you said it, Brody, anywhere from 70 to 95 wins. I don't see them going that extreme in either direction, but I do think this is a team that should be able to make the playoffs. And adding Corbin Burnes to a playoff team is absolutely huge, no matter which playoff team that is. So, I'm excited for the Diamondbacks next year. Brandon Pfaadt is great. He goes deep into games. I think he could turn into, and I think it'll be this year, one of the few guys in the league who's capable of throwing 200 innings. Whether he hits that mark, you know, remains to be seen. That's a particularly high benchmark. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Seattle's got their shit figured out for sure, but I love Brandon Pfaadt. I think he's going to be a great four for them. I mean, he might even have a better season than Zach Gallen or Merrill Kelly. It's possible he ends the season as their two. Who knows? But and then you have those two lefties, Eduardo Rodriguez, Jordan Montgomery, that are sort of question marks for them. You know, if we're talking about those guys as your five and you're just hoping that one of them turns into a serviceable arm that can go out there once every 5 days and allow your really dominant guys to get some rest, would be a huge win for them. So I feel good about the Diamondbacks, but we should probably move on here. I've got a few more signings we can't go quite as long on, but I did want to get out of the way here just to be able to say that we covered them on the pod. We talked about Sean Manaea already going back to the Mets, but he signed for 3 years, $75 million, $25 million average, of course. This was particularly notable to me. I mean, one, because Brody, you and I talked after the Juan Soto signing about how
pitching
depleted the Mets pitching looked. Pitching. Yeah. How it was like, who is going to
Clay
fill
Holmes
out this rotation?
Yeah. Like, oh, that's God. Not good.
So, yeah. I mean, Manaea, they changed his arm slot towards the end of last year, and yep. He ended up pitching like Chris Sale. So I guess this means that the Mets are confident that the pitching gains that they made with him last year are legit and sustainable moving forward. So it's a big show of confidence in Manaea that, you know, he's going to go out there and he's going to be maybe the 2 or 3 starter on this team, depending on who else they're able to get before opening day.
I think I said this when I was on with you guys during the playoffs about when the Yankees were in the ALCS and the Mets were in the NLCS. I said if the Yankees face Manaea in the World Series, he's going to throw the first perfect game since Don Larsen, because the Yankees last year with their struggles against lefties, specifically those lefties with that side-slinging angle. I mean, and that's what Manaea had turned into, like, against all odds. Had an amazing season and pitched very, very well in the playoffs, at least in the first couple rounds until he kind of hit a wall against the Dodgers. But, shut down that Phillies lineup in the NLDS to 7 innings, as we talked about back then. Not as impressive as you may think. I thought that Phillies team was overrated. We've been through that many times. I really was impressed with what he was able to do with his career and how they were able to kind of turn his career around with the Mets. And, yeah, I think this was a signing both sides had to make. I think that they value him more than any other team would, and I think that he wanted to go back there and slots right into that rotation right where he left off, and should be a pretty good deal for both sides.
I'm with it. Walker Buehler to the Boston Red Sox, 1 year, $21 million. Sure. This is way more money than I expected him to get. That's another real show of confidence. You know, the Red Sox must feel like he's good for 150 innings next year, or they wouldn't have given him so much money to pitch for them for 1 year. But that's another team looking to compete, sort of open up their window this year, as we just talked about extensively. But and it's going to be a big piece for them, because that rotation was looking a lot like the Mets, as in not very good. Garrett Crochet, Walker Buehler behind him.
I got 4 words on that, which is good luck with that.
Yeah. sort of a speed round here, because we are a little pressed for time, but I've got Gleyber Torres on the same contract that Justin Verlander got with the Giants and Charlie Morton got with the Orioles. 1 year, $15 million. I think we all probably expected more for him, But at the same time, you know, Glaber's been enough of a question mark, and his consistency has not been entirely there, that it doesn't really surprise me to see this sort of like a go out and prove it type year. You know, if he goes out and he shows that he can find success on a team that's not the Yankees, especially in a ballpark like Detroit's, that if he goes out and proves that he can still be an above average offensive player, I think maybe he gets that deal next year instead of this one. But I was definitely expecting, you know, maybe like a 3-4 year contract for Torres instead of a one and done. But that like number of 1 year $15 million deals, I think, is particularly interesting, because seems to me that Glaber has more value to a team than a 43-year-old Justin Verlander or a 41-year-old Charlie Morton would. But right. I guess that's what the market looks like. Do you guys have any thoughts on Glaber?
I love to see you go. Hate to watch you leave. Sorry, buddy.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I thought that he would have gotten a little more, if you remember back to our initial prediction episode. I think I thought he was going to end up somewhere around, like, I don't exactly remember, but somewhere like in, like, you know, the 180 range or something like that, going to Seattle. It's a good deal for Detroit. I mean, they can get a very good, you know, above average bat for really not that much money for a team that's hoping to compete next year. So I'm going to be curious to see how he does in a little bit of a bigger stadium and with less pressure, but I like Glaber enough. I'm not rooting against the guy at all. I am excited to see what he does. And the Tigers are a fun team, so, you know, maybe he'll have some fun out there and he can go get a little bit more money from Seattle next year.
Glaber was a good Yankee. It doesn't have to be all black and white that, like, exactly. Oh, he wasn't an 8-time All-Star and didn't win a World Series. I mean, this is a guy who had a very successful career with the Yankees.
He's definitely, like, people are saying that he was like a bust of a prospect. I mean, if you, absolutely not. Like, that's not, anybody who says it was a bad deal or whatever, like, I do think that we'll miss him a little bit, but we won't really miss him.
His last hit as a Yankee was a home run at Yankee Stadium in the World Series, so that's how I will choose to remember Glaber. Next up, Teoscar Hernandez back to the Dodgers, 3 years, $66 million. Yeah, exactly. Great fit, worked super well in 2024 and should continue to.
Glad he's not close to us. Keep going.
Me too. Me too. I was just happy to get one of my predictions correct, that I had him going back there. So I wanted to talk about the first base carousel that saw a lot of moves over the past couple weeks, sort of in that span of like 3 or 4 days. First up was Christian Walker finally making his free agent decision, signing with the Houston Astros, going to bash in the Crawford boxes. Right-handed slugger going to a team that badly needed a player at his position. 3 years, $60 million, $20 million per year. I was a little surprised that the Yankees didn't go out and offer him that contract, but instead they went out and got Paul Goldschmidt for 1 year, $12.5 million. Seems pretty mutually beneficial to me. Yankees badly needed a first baseman, of course, and Goldie looked really good over the, like, the last half of the year. I mean, you know, there have been times where it has looked like he is done at the plate, like his best days are well behind him, but I am not convinced that he is incapable of going out there and putting up good production as the everyday first baseman for the New York Yankees. Do you guys have thoughts on these two signings, Christian Walker, Paul Goldschmidt?
I mean, I wasn't someone who was big banging the Christian Walker drum. I was a little concerned about the age factor and possibly how his knees were holding up. Things like that tend to worry me. So I really was not too upset to see him go to Houston. I think they'll probably be fine. 3 years is not too much of a risk for someone at his age. But, yeah, I mean, I wasn't crazy about Paul Goldschmidt, but I think this is, you know, your obvious pivot move. And, yeah, I mean, it's there's no such thing as a bad one-year deal, right? So might as well give him a shot.
For sure. Okay, had a couple of first base trades. We had Nathaniel Lowe. Is it Lowe or Lau? I never remember with those guys. It's Lowe.
It's Nathaniel Lowe and Brandon Lau.
That's right. That's right. And Josh Lowe is Nathaniel Lowe's brother.
And Josh
Lowe. But not Brandon Lau's brother. What a mess.
And Derek Lowe, who was not involved in any of that.
Yeah, so
just good to keep in mind.
He is good to always remember. Nathaniel Lowe traded to the Washington Nationals straight up for Robert Garcia. not particularly interesting, but he will slot into that first base role for the Nats, which they are building a fun lineup. You know, James Wood called up, Dylan Cruz called up. That'll be the future of that organization. They also landed the number one overall pick in the draft this year, so you think maybe they'll be selecting Jackson Holliday's younger brother, Ethan. Of course, the draft could change so much between now and June, or now and July. I am pretty excited about the future of the Nats, and Nathaniel Lowe is a perfectly serviceable bat to slot in there. You got a World Series ring with the Texas Rangers. What more can you hope for? And then, Brody, you already mentioned the other one a little bit of Josh Naylor to the Arizona Diamondbacks. If we want to just move past that, that's okay with me, but do you guys have anything else on there?
Nope.
I don't think so. I do want to just bring up the I just saw a it's a list of payrolls at the end of last season and where they stand currently. I'm just curious if you guys want to throw a guess out on how many teams have currently increased payrolls from the end of last season to where they are right now.
Probably not too many. Probably like six.
So the Mets are interesting because right now, currently, they have the biggest difference between the end of last season's payroll and the current payroll in the other direction. They are currently $80 million under the end of last season's payroll, mostly because of losing the books of Verlander and Scherzer are probably officially off the books.
Yeah, but you have to add in they're going to...
Yes, I Soto mean, too. But they still they got rid of Winker. Winker. I think they were paying him. They are currently the least added or the most lost in payroll. So bad first guess from Mort. But okay. how many teams do you think have added?
The Astros.
Well, give me a number out of 30. How many teams?
Three.
Nolan.
Six.
Six is right.
Oh shit! Six
teams that have added payroll. The Phillies, the Orioles, the Tigers, the Padres, the Dodgers, and the Angels. Now, the Angels and the Dodgers have added less than 350,000 total, but the other ones are all over $5 million.
Who have the Phillies added?
The Phillies have added $35 million in payroll. I don't know exactly where that's coming from.
Is it Lizardo?
Lizardo, yeah.
Must be, because they are right now leading the pack in added payroll. I'm going to check right now.
That's a little strange to me. I wouldn't have expected that. Yeah. Who else did they sign?
Philly has signed, some minor league contracts, one-year contracts.
Max Kepler? I mean, that's a...
Jordan Romano?
It doesn't matter. They're going to be out in the first round anyway.
It's got to be Jordan Romano or Jesus Lizardo.
Arbitration? They could... I mean, a lot of these guys are... They have a lot of arbitration guys. Ranger Suarez, Amundo Sosa, Alec Bohm, Jesus Lizardo, Brandon Marsh, Bryson Stott, Garrett Stubbs, Jose Ruiz. So all these guys are probably making absolutely nothing, and they, you know, now have to pay them probably like $5-6 million each. So
yeah,
that could probably have some...
I saw a news item that Bryce Harper is promoting raw milk, which should make him even more of a fan favorite in Philadelphia.
They will love that down there. Unfortunately, that might shorten his career a little bit due to stomach pains. But we'll
end his life.
I saw Bryce Harper making TikToks where he did not look particularly healthy, so he might be on the old RFK diet, and I might be trying to trade him in my dynasty league. But we'll see about that. Last two moves before we move on to our film of the week that I am particularly excited to talk about. Diego Cartaya. Oh my God, what happened to that guy? One of the top catching prospects in the game just as recently as 2 years ago, plateaued entirely and gets DFA'd by the Los Angeles Dodgers and ends up being traded to the Twins for Jose Vasquez, who is a person I have not heard of. I don't think this means that other GMs should go out and just start trading prospects like hotcakes. Doesn't mean they're all going to go out and be busts, but man, what a disappointment this turned out to be for the Dodgers, who, I mean, they have an abundance of riches, so they'll be fine, but you did get the sense that maybe they could go out and include Cartaya in one of their prospect bundles that they seem to ship out every year for some veteran bat who turns into the reincarnation of Reggie Jackson in October. But no, had to just cut bait there. I found that one to be a little interesting. And then Gavin Lux, another Dodgers trade, goes to the Cincinnati Reds, gives them their 27th infielder, traded for Mike Sirota, who was drafted this past year, and then pick 37, it should be, in the draft. So do you guys have any thoughts on either of those deals?
No, but I did just send you a photo of Bryce Harper on a recent TikTok where he really does look terrible.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what happens. The Diego Cartaya thing is just...
it is shocking.
It's kind of just one of those things with him where, happens from time to time where a guy's just hyped for so long, and then just eventually there's just no opportunity there, and it kind of turns into... Like, the guy I keep thinking about is Marco Luciano. It's obviously a name that you'd heard for like 5 years in a row on these prospect lists and barely, you know, gets a little bit of an opportunity and doesn't shine. And it's like, okay, the change of scenery candidate. And that's like the only thing you can do with him at some point. You know what I mean?
Moore also has been very much on the record saying that you should get rid of all your catching prospects as soon as they become well-known names.
You should trade all your catching prospects. Yes, you should. Yeah. And it just really briefly on that, in case that sounds confusing, I do think that there is a tendency to overvalue tools in catchers such as contact and power because catchers are so rare. But yet at the same time, most catching prospects will move off of catcher, and then those tools will become low at other positions. So that is why I believe that that is the case. But yeah, other than that, I got nothing on that.
Any other baseball thoughts? Any other transactions we want to touch on before we shift gears?
Yeah, I think we should probably move on to the movie.
Let's do it.
How does it feel?
How does it feel?
We met a young man. He dropped in on us out of nowhere, and he played us a song. In that moment, we got a feeling we were getting a glimpse of the future.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a heart, it's a heart, oh it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heartbreak. And it's gonna fall.
It is A Complete Unknown, the new Bob Dylan biopic from James Mangold, who seems to be establishing a reputation as the king of these great man music biopics after 2004's Walk the Line, Johnny Cash biopic starring Joaquin Phoenix. Now he's back 20 years later, and we have Timothée Chalamet as Bob Dylan. This movie takes place between the years of 1960 and 1965, chronicling Dylan's arrival into New York City, his ascent as the folk hero that he will be known as forever for the rest of time, with a particular emphasis on 1965 and the seismic shift in not only his own career, but music as a whole when he switched from acoustic guitars to electric. I know you guys have been big Bob Dylan fans your whole lives. It is not particularly the case with me. I did not grow up on his music, but in the past few years, I have gone down the Bob Dylan rabbit hole. I've been fully converted, and I love a number of his albums. I have not gotten to all 40 of them, but, you know, I still just feel like I'm...
50.
50, fine. I still feel like I'm scratching the surface of who he is, what he's done, and what he has to say. So I kind of want to let you guys cook on this a little bit more. I mean, Morgan, we got you on today to talk about this movie. You were so dead set against it for a while when it was announced, against the idea of Timothée Chalamet playing Bob Dylan. So I'm curious what changed for you in that regard, what made you like this movie so much, and what you think it did well.
Yeah, I mean, when this movie was announced, I'm a Dylanologist. Like, Bob Dylan's one of my heroes, and always has been, pretty much. So I was kind of against the idea of any Bob Dylan biopic after I'm Not There, which is the terrific 2007 movie where, you know, it's kind of experimental, but you have six actors playing Dylan through various eras of his life. And I thought that was so definitive and so well done that I could not see another movie being made about him, and especially one starring Timothy Chalamet, who at the time of the announcement, I kind of perceived to be this like new hotness in Hollywood and not someone who was like a really great technical actor. And that's my own ignorance. You know, I'm not the biggest, you know, which is weird because I've appeared on this podcast several times. I'm not the biggest movie buff, but I had, perceived Timothy Chalamet to be something less than what he was. And that became clear to me after watching Dune and after seeing, you know, some of his more recent performances, that this is a guy who can really sink his teeth into a role. And
we need to get him on this podcast, by the way.
That's so true.
And he's a big aficionado. Now, that's not going to happen, but...
That's our white whale.
And then, you know, as the trailers came out and as I heard him singing and saw him inhabiting Dylan, I was like, okay, this is... someone who can do the job, I'm going to go into this with an open mind. And I got more and more excited for it as it came down the pipe. And when we saw the movie and when he first breaks into a song for Woody in the hospital scene, you know, I closed my eyes. I was like, I could believe that this is Bob, you know. So a great performance by him. Honestly, I mean, you just got to give it up. This guy was fully immersed in the role. And really inhabited the main thing that I told Brody that was important to capture about Bob Dylan, which is that he's a tremendous jackass. You know, he's someone who is a contrarian for the sake of contrarian's sake, which is nowadays not the most fun guy to be, but in the 60s was a little more lighthearted than it is now. So he was someone who would just piss people off because he was bored, and still does that to some extent. And that's one thing that I thought Chalamet captured perfectly, especially in the scenes with Joan Baez, played by the fantastic Monica Barbaro. I just thought that they really captured that element of his personality really, really well. And I just love this movie. I mean, I thought that it was a little safe, obviously. It was a little paint by numbers, but like I said in my review, I love the numbers, so I can't complain about that.
Yeah, well said. I agree. I mean, you know more about Bob Dylan than I do, than most people do, I think. And most people is like most, like 98% of people. But, you know, as somebody who mostly just loves the music, doesn't know a ton about him as a person other than the main things, like the...
received
the
wisdom.
Icon. Yeah, like, you know, going and, you know, becoming electric, becoming like a rock star, like being kind of leading the pack on that, being one of the best songwriters in the last however long.
History.
Centuries, history, whatever. Like, that's kind of what I knew, aside from, you know, he was also a dick, knew that. But, yeah, I mean, this movie really kind of opened up my eyes into what he was like. And also, you know, on a personal level, I have always loved music. I play music all the time. A song that I play with my band is in our intro. Like, that has always been a huge part of who I am and what I want to be. And I've always wanted to write songs. I've never been able to. And actually, after seeing this, and just because of one thing that he said to Joan Baez in this movie, honestly, really helped me like try to write songs. Like, I've been, since I've seen it, I've been trying to write music more. And I'm having more success in the last week than I've had literally in my entire life trying to write music, which is just where he says, you're trying too hard. Your songs just sound like an oil painting in a dentist's office. And like, I mean, that is not that I'm like this amazing flowery songwriter, but like I'm obsessed with jazz, always have been, but I also love folk and like any kind of just simple guitar song. And like, since seeing this, I've just kind of like, I've stopped trying to be overly flowery, over dramatic, like anything like too creative, not trying to be too smart for my own good. And all of a sudden, like, I've been writing stuff that I actually like more. And just, like, there's something that is so simple in his songwriting that's also just, it's all just simple chords that he just fingerpicks. And then he has, like, this beautiful poetry that goes over the top of it. And that's all it is. Like, and it's fantastic. And then, you know, he moves on to more, obviously, like, rock and roll stuff later. You know, at this point in the movie, or in his life that the movie portrays, it's the dream that if you ever have thought about wanting to become a musician, it's what you want to do. You want to show up somewhere new with nothing but a guitar. You want to play songs for somebody, realize that you have talent, and then they realize that you have talent, and then they're just going to say, all right, here, go play in front of people and see what you can make of yourself. It's amazing. And he did that, and that's, you know, New York in the 60s was the perfect place for it. I found myself really wishing that I could explore that era in New York. I feel like that is, you know, I spent a lot of time in the city now, obviously lived there, the whole thing. But it's just, it's not like that, you know, like there's nowhere that's like that. So there's so much of this that I just kind of, I was jealous of, you know, which I thought was interesting. And I loved his back and forth with Joan Baez, with Sylvie, who's Suze Rotolo. Like, I loved it. I found myself completely fascinated, just wanting more to watch him, just because he's so enrapturing. Like, he captures the imagination in a way that you see yourself. You want to see more of him. You want to hear him more. And I've just been listening to nothing but him since we saw this.
Right.
Me too, actually.
And I also, oh yeah, definitely. I mean, and I also, I want to touch on the relationship with Sylvie Russo, who in real life, as Brody said, was Susie Rotolo, which is a name that I whispered to Brody during the movie we saw together, and I said, that's not her name. But apparently,
I remembered. I listened.
Yes. Apparently, Bob reached out in real life to James Mangold and told him just, Susie Rotolo has been dead for a number of years now, but he said, I don't want her name in the movie, so change
your
it.
Name.
Right, to Sylvie Russo. Which was nice of him, but I really love that relationship too. And I think I tweeted something like this, but you know, I've never seen a movie fully explore the concept of what I would call I'll just hang out here, which is when you're like a dipshit guy and hanging out with like a much more successful woman, and she like leaves you at her apartment while she goes off and does like something really interesting, and you're like hanging out at her apartment waiting for her to get home, which I really loved in this movie, because that was most of the early part. It was just Bob Dylan lounging around at Sylvie's apartment writing songs. I really thought that was funny and relatable. But yeah, I mean, I loved it. I just thought it was awesome. And Nolan, I'd be curious on your thoughts, because obviously I look at this from the point of view of someone who's a major Dylan head, but from the point of view as a film, you know, I'm not as qualified to talk about it as maybe you are and Brody are, so I'd be curious.
I think, Brody, some of what you were talking about, like, creatively with this movie, how it, like, inspired you and how you sort of have changed up your approach to, like, songwriting. I mean, I kind of want to touch on that for a little bit, too, because, I mean, you know, I want to do creative things as well. You want to make music. I want to make movies. And I think Dylan, like, he fits into that conversation so well, because it's like there are some people where, regardless of what medium they're in, you know, what kind of art they produce, where I have seen their work or heard their work and have just thought, that is not something that, you know, even if I attain every single level of success that I ever want to and I make all of my wildest dreams come true, this is a singularity that I could just never approach. And like, I think of Jean-Luc Godard, Orson Welles, Thomas Pynchon, for artists like that, where I'm just like, holy fuck, this is enrapturing and unlike anything I have ever heard before, and also puts decades of work that I had previously been aware of in an entirely new light. And Bob Dylan is absolutely one of those artists. It's like, who else has been recording and touring music for over 60 years? Is arguably the greatest songwriter of all time, with dozens of instantly recognizable classics, was always evolving his sound, recorded over 40 albums, like we said, has done the never-ending tour for like over three decades now, won the Nobel Prize in Literature. It's a resume that no one else has. So,
absolutely.
But I was curious as well about I'm Not There, that you were talking about, Morgan, because I feel like that is not a movie I've seen, and I am ashamed of that. I wanted to watch it for this episode. I was going to try to even do it this morning. I watched Don't Look Back, the D.A. Pennebaker documentary on Dylan from the same...
Yeah, also terrific.
Yeah, I really liked it. From the same period of time that the like second half of this movie is taking place in, with this shift to electric music, where it's like the whole world is sort of chasing Dylan and he's responding very antagonistically to it. And I thought they sort of go like hand in hand with each other, where Don't Look Back felt to me like it's a little bit comparable to the Get Back Beatles documentary that Peter Jackson did a couple of years ago, where it's like,
if you want to talk about inspiring too, amazing.
Where it's like you kind of just get to like watch Dylan's process, and like you don't really see him write a whole lot in that documentary, but like you see the people who he was around, the people he liked, the people that he really didn't like, people like Donovan, who he felt he had this like contentious relationship with. My review of the movie was, this time it was Donovan who was outmeted. It's just really incredible to kind of see Dylan work, to see the Beatles work in these types of like documentaries that can take more of a hands-off approach. And that's not entirely true to what Don't Look Back is. You know, there's also a lot of very pointed commentary in it from Pennebaker himself, sort of statements that it seemed like he's making about Dylan and his career at the time. And so it's pretty fascinating to, I think, see how those things have aged as well. I did want to watch the Todd Haynes film as well, because it's like,
yeah.
You know, I, like I said, I feel like I'm barely scratching the surface with Bob Dylan, because he has had so many different, like, eras of his career and so many different sounds and, like, artistic missions that he's taken right. And over the 60 years that he has made music. And, yeah, so it's like, I feel like the approach that Todd Haynes took is one that is specific to Dylan and could also be incredibly successful. But, like I said, I didn't watch the movie, so I can't really comment right. on it.
So I'm Not There is, just for some context, obviously, like you said, it's a Todd Haynes film. Todd Haynes, obviously, these days is known for, like, May, December, and what's the other one? Dark Water, I think it's called?
Yeah, he did Dark Waters with Mark...
Pretty impressive pull from
Mark
me.
Ruffalo, yeah. I that's actually a movie that I didn't watch because I knew it was going to piss me off too much, because it's about, like, a company that, like, poisons the water with chemicals, and Mark Ruffalo has to go on this deep adventure to, like, expose the truth, and it ends up, like, not even mattering. They just have to pay, like, a fine that's not even half of 1 year's profit for the company, and so, like, all of that's these cool. people they effectively killed, you know. It's a very
sounds uplifting
American capitalist movie, does that whole thing. But Todd Haynes also very well known for Carol, which is a great film with Kate Blanchett, and what's the other one I really like is Safe from the 90s with Julianne Moore. It's kind of like, you want to talk about the end of the 20th century, you talk about Safe. You want to talk about the 21st century, I think you talk about Dark Waters.
So interesting that you mentioned Cate Blanchett, because in I'm Not There, which, by the way, just for some background, it came out so long ago that I actually saw it with me and my friends rented it from Blockbuster, which is pretty incredible, one of the last ones in the country at the time. Yeah, I'm Not There is a movie starring Cate Blanchett among six actors that play Bob Dylan, as I said. Those actors are Cate Blanchett, Christian Bale, Richard Gere, Heath Ledger, Marcus Carl Franklin, and Ben Whishaw, who are, you know, all actors that have gone on or had at the time incredible success. But the point of I'm Not There, and it's also something that was kind of hammered home a little bit in The Complete Unknown, is that Bob Dylan is an incredible liar, as the best artists are. Bob Dylan told so many stories about different aspects of his life. The one we see most repeated in A Complete Unknown that they didn't fully get right is he keeps talking about working at a carnival. That was actually something he talked about traveling in a circus. I think they kind of cleaned it up for some reason. But we see this when Joan Baez sees the scrapbook of his life and Sylvie Russo kind of tries to put it away. They don't spell it out, but it internalizes in Joan Baez, oh, this guy's lying about his whole life. And that's what I'm Not There is. It depicts, like, these six different possible people that Bob Dylan could be, and these six different stories that he's told about his life. And it's very experimental. It's very almost psychedelic. It kind of portrays things in a very overtly symbolic way, such as, like, for example, like, when he breaks into, like, a Rolling Stone at the Newport Folk Festival, which we see at the end of the movie, or I'm sorry, into Maggie's Farm. They portray it in the movie as him taking out a machine gun and just massacring the crowd. And these types of things that are, like, it's kind of like, oh, this is symbolism. Do you get the symbolism? Do you get it? And it can be a bit heavy-handed at times, but it's a really, really great movie, and it just hammers home that thing about Bob Dylan, like, the best artists will lie to your face and you will just eat it up. And I think that that is very impressive and something that the movie A Complete Unknown could have touched on a little bit more for my liking. But, yeah, I thought it was really good, and I would recommend it to anyone that liked this one.
That did change, or at least add a new layer to my appreciation of Maggie's Farm, because it's like I didn't really know too much of the context behind that song. Oh, I felt yeah. like, given the time of its release and who Bob Dylan was and a lot of the people that he associated with, I sort of thought of it as sort of like a protest anthem. Like, it might have been sort of a song against the government and, like, America. You know, maybe there are elements of that, but in the context of the movie, I saw it as, oh, this is about not wanting to be told what he can and can't play, and not wanting right. like Pete Seeger to mm-hmm. be all up in his grill about, you got to go out and play Blowing in the Wind, Bob, or they're gonna kill you.
That, even that, and being owned by, you know, record companies,
exactly,
like, whatever, yeah. all of it. It's all of it, and, you know. But Morgan had an interesting point about Pete Seeger being pissed about that, which this is probably a good time to bring that up. But I also have a point about his own interpretation of his songwriting, which, Morgan, I'll let you say the Pete Seeger thing, because I want to get to that also.
Yeah, so the Pete Seeger obviously is presented in this movie as kind of a, I don't want to say a villain, but like a quasi-antagonist to Bob as he tries to expand his career and go electric.
He's a fundamentalist in the movie who is upset that he's trying to push the envelope.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. Edward Norton, incredible, as always.
What
one
a performance.
Of my favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize that was Edward Norton. I didn't think about who that was. I just was like...
You were just, oh, that's Pete Seeger.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So, weird backstory to that. I've actually heard Pete Seeger talk. We went on a field trip as a kid to his Clearwater sloop and kind of heard him speak. He lived a very long life. But anyway, so...
About like 99.
So the Pete Seeger story at the end where he's really furious about the electric music and looking for an axe to chop the cable until he's stopped by his wife, Toshi, that's all pretty apocryphal. But it, like, a lot of things about that Newport Festival are taken just for dramatic effect. Like, he had broken up with Suze Rotolo by that time, so Sylvia Russo would not have been there. There would have been no, like, big confrontation at the ferry. Johnny Cash was not present to play this, like, Christ-like figure that he is in the movie. That didn't happen. And I'm glad they put him in just because I love Johnny Cash, and obviously as an homage to Walk the Line. I'm glad that
and
was in there.
And what a performance from that guy, by the way. It was incredible.
Terrific. He was not at the Newport Jazz Festival. More specifically, he was not backstage begging Bob Dylan to take the stage for an encore. When they did launch into the song, the crowd reaction was very mixed, and they did get booed at the end, and some things were thrown. But Pete Seeger backstage was not looking for an axe to chop the cable. It's arguable if he was even upset. He did comment that he wanted the sound turned off, but that was more because he said later that the sound was so bad that he wanted it turned off. Like, it wasn't mixed well. He said he didn't have an issue with Bob Dylan playing electric guitar. So, yeah, you can look at this movie as the entire climax of the film could be in some way made up. But, I mean, it makes for a good story. Like I said, Bob Dylan's a fantastic liar, as are every artist, so they're just lying to you a little bit more. I will say the one thing they did get correct is that Alan Lomax in the movie and Peter Yarrow, who is Peter from Peter, Paul, and Mary, who just died this past week, actually, and was also not a great guy, are the ones also portrayed as being angry. They were actually angry about him going electric, but Pete Seeger was not maybe as angry and was just upset that the music quality was so bad. So, yeah, they take a little bit of liberty, but, like, you know, that's like every historical movie. You know, it's not a documentary, it's a story. And I appreciated that they did try to pull one over on the audience, just like Dylan himself would have.
I didn't know a ton about Pete Seeger going into this, aside from, you know, the fact that he's one of the founding fathers of, like, American folk, and that he was very in tune with the, like, protest anthem scene, one of the main guys in that regard. But my takeaway from this film and from this Edward Norton performance is that he was sort of a Mr. Rogers type figure.
In some ways, yeah, but he was also a communist, like a very loud and vocal communist. So there were a lot of people in America who were not fans of Pete Seeger. And even when he died and Barack Obama eulogized him, you had a huge reaction from the right about, like, he had had, you know, remarks that were pro-USSR in the past and, like, stuff that would be beyond the scope of this podcast to discuss. I love Pete Seeger. I think he was awesome, and I think that he was ahead of his time and his views. But a lot of people were
blackballed now.
And he was blackballed then.
They showed that in the movie,
But yeah, he was a communist. He was a loud and outspoken communist. And he was not really like a wholesome figure, which the movie had to portray him as to contrast him with Dylan's more, you know, rebellious persona. But
rock and roll, black leather jacket type stuff.
Yeah, that was necessary for the movie. Yeah. But I do think that Edward Norton captured his mannerisms really well. But I also think that maybe they didn't capture the kind of more controversial side of Pete Seeger that definitely existed.
So I also just wanted to touch on the way that, like, Nolan, when you said your reading of Maggie's Farm, like, kind of changed because of, you know, like, what it means. As Morgan keeps on alluding to, he's a fantastic liar, lies all the time, you know, doesn't really like to do interviews and all that. I watched a bunch of interviews of him throughout the years the other day, like, just because I was curious to see, like, if he changed the way that he would speak about certain things or whatever. You know, if, like, back then, like, how accurate did it seem to be to him? And even in the 60s and, like, there was an interview with him in, like, the late 90s or the early 2000s. He said that his songs, like, he said, I just write them. People, you can interpret them however you want. There's no meaning. I don't think there's meaning. I just write them. They're entertainment. People come to see me to be entertained. They make it out that I'm something else, that I'm not. I think I'm closer to Elvis than anything. And then people just say, you know, whatever they want to say. It's like, it's really interesting.
That strikes me as bullshit.
Well, so I don't know about that.
Like, at least in a sense, you know, like, what I mean? Like, there's definitely a lot of meaning behind his lyrics.
It, Yes, there's meaning behind it, but I don't
think just doesn't want to explain it to people.
Exactly.
I think it's that, and I do think that he doesn't care for the image that is concocted of him being this, like, this icon of, you know, progressive movement or whatever. I don't know, like, I mean, this is part of him being so enigmatic, it makes him endlessly debatable about what the songs mean, what he means, what he's talking about, all these things. But
He doesn't want to be used as a mascot for anything, that's stuff he agrees with. And
as you said, he tried to tank his own fame and his own career by saying and doing extremely contentious things.
He was a big fan of Lee Harvey Oswald.
He's called himself a Zionist. He's gone to Israel. Like, and then he's like, "What was that about?" And he was like, "Well, I just thought that they would be mad at me."
He's so impossible to read because you don't know what his views are. You can broadly guess based on his works, but he will not be put in one box, and that's something I kind of like about him. I think that's
something that everybody likes. he hates your opinion of him, whatever it is.
He doesn't want to be like a mascot.
He doesn't want to hear it, doesn't like it.
Right.
Which is awesome.
And there were people on Twitter that I kind of broadly observed this but didn't like engage because I would have gotten too mad. But, you know, there are like Zoomers on Twitter who were saying like he was a sellout because he stopped making protest music and that people should listen to Phil Oakes instead of Bob Dylan, which I would go ahead and say, Phil Oakes might have had like better opinions. Phil Oakes is a much worse artist than Bob Dylan, so it depends what you want. Are listen most to music people. For yeah, yeah. like if you just want to listen to someone you agree with, then sure, go listen to Phil Oakes. But
can I interject for one quick second? I was literally listening to Phil Oakes before we started recording this podcast.
He's a good artist. Like he has very good songs. He's not Bob Dylan.
No, God, no.
And more broadly, don't just listen to the artist you agree with most politically. That's not like a good way to engage with anything, you know?
Like, I love Paul McCartney so much. Paul McCartney is my, like, also, like, a hero of mine. He's also not Bob Dylan. I think Paul McCartney and Bob Dylan are the two, well, and Paul Simon, are the greatest living songwriters. They're all very different. Paul Simon and Bob Dylan are a little closer to each other. But Paul McCartney is, like, probably the best melody writer. He knows how to write a pop song, knows how to get in your ear better than anybody. And even then, I would still say, he's not Bob Dylan. Like, there's the way that his music works, like, melodically, the way that it can stick in your brain, and also the beautiful, beautiful lyrics that he has. There's not much that you can compare to him and say, like, yeah, that's close. Again, Simon, Paul McCartney, the only ones that would be like, yeah. You know,
yeah, can I just, real quick, I got to touch on something, because I also saw people, like, repeating on Twitter with something that's been said for, like, 70 years at this point, which is, oh, Bob Dylan's not a good singer. And it's
so stupid.
Nonsense.
Fuck off. I will explain this to you if I have to. What do you want from art? If you want to listen to a good singer, you can listen to fucking Josh Groban. He is a songwriter, and he is a singer with a unique voice that tells unique stories, and his voice sounds like the stories that he's talking about. Yep. That's all you can ask from a singer. And
people complain about good guitars. That's what I said. Right. Like, you don't listen to Joe Satriani. That's not what you're doing.
Like, yeah, it's calling Kurt Cobain a bad guitarist, calling Didi Ramone a bad bassist. What do you want from art? What do you want from music? Do you want it to be technically correct?
Ringo's a bad drummer. Okay. Right. Sure. Shut up.
You could listen to computer generated music if that's what you want. It just drives me nuts.
You listen to math rock? Okay, then shut up.
I had a conversation with one of my friends, probably like 2 years ago or so at this point, where we were talking about our like top five singers, like pure like singing voices. And I didn't like necessarily put Bob Dylan in my list, but I mentioned that he was like a contender for it. He'd be like on my like short list. And he got so mad at me. He was like, what are you talking about? And his list was unique. Like Steven Tyler. And like,
oh, shut up.
Fucking, who's the guy from Journey? Steve Perry. Great singer, but he's not, he's not Bob Dylan. So I don't know. I just wanted to dig up that old argument just to bury it again.
You can win that one.
It's like the people, these are people who would, you know, consume AI art, are people who are saying that.
Yes.
And like, and if you
it's
believe that.
It's a fake opinion. It's not a real opinion. It's something that you think you should say.
And
it's
if that's, like, and if that's something that you believe and you're listening to this, I appreciate you for listening. You're wrong and you should interrogate why you're wrong, but I don't hold it against you as long as you change your opinion.
Keep listening to the podcast, but change your mind.
Right, change your mind. Joan Baez, we should talk about real quick.
Yeah,
she's amazing.
Joan Baez is someone that in history has been kind of swallowed up by this movement and was someone who did remain active in protest movements, unlike Bob Dylan, and someone who married a Vietnam War protester, David Harris, and has continuously, to even to this day, remained active in protests, and basically a 70-year activist, that has kind of come at expense of her popular music career. Not so much now. I mean, I think that now she's respected as kind of the elder stateswoman of folk. She appears on stage with Lana Del Rey. You know, she was in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and these are great things. But for a while, her commitment to activism did drop her career a little bit off the map. But in this movie, she's portrayed as kind of Bob Dylan's kind of like side love affair that's like forbidden because he's with Sylvie Russo.
Tempestuous, like alternate. Like, there,
yeah,
you know.
There's no evidence to support that Joan Baez and Bob Dylan had any kind of affair while he was dating Susie Rotolo. And also the way they meet and start, you know, making out, like when he's on stage in a club,
the
and she sees it, it's like,
yeah,
this is very much apocryphal. But yeah, I mean, Monica Barbara was awesome, and her voice as Joan Baez may be closer to the actual Joan Baez than Chalamet is to Dylan. The highlight of the movie for me overall was the duet of It Ain't Me, Babe, which is one of my favorite songs ever. Sung as a duet between those two incredibly talented actors is just really, really good. And yeah, I just hope this movie leads to more appreciation for Joan Baez, because she's awesome, has always been awesome, has been consistent with her views, consistently correct on everything pretty much for 70 years. And I just really love Joan Baez. And I just hope that maybe a younger generation gets introduced to her now.
Yeah, Bryce's take, friend of the pod and girlfriend of me, Bryce, who did not know anything about Joan Baez before this, has been listening to her all week and is now obsessed with her. That was her takeaway from the movie. He's a dick because he's, you know, a dick, and, you know, and she's awesome, which she's completely right about. So it really, you know, it's interesting. It's an interesting read. I mean, she still like appreciates the music or whatever. I think he's, if you can't really look past his very objectionable treatment of these two women as depicted in the movie, makes sense why you would come out just being a huge fan of Joan Baez, which, you know, it really is, it checks out. I would expect that her appreciation would spike after this. She deserves it. She is that talented. She's an amazing singer, amazing songwriter. And this actress, by the way, apparently did not sing and did not play guitar before this this performance. So
wow, that's
great
job.
Props. Absolute props. I'm very critical when people play instruments in movies, and both of them, I think, did a pretty good job.
Yeah, I had seen her in Top Gun Maverick, and I had seen her in a couple episodes of Chicago PD, which is not something I really watch for fun, but I've seen episodes of for some reason. But yeah, she's incredible in this movie.
I did not realize that was her in Top Gun Maverick.
Yeah, and that's why I'm here, to provide information about movies, you know. But yeah, I mean, yeah, the supporting cast is incredible. Scoop McNairy, one of my favorite, like, random character actors as Woody Guthrie, was a great surprise for me because I had not looked at the cast coming into the movie. He was awesome. That story is largely true, that the reason Dylan came to New York was to visit Woody Guthrie in the hospital. He did not meet Pete Seeger there. That part is not true, but, you know, it's just more convenient for storytelling. But yes, Woody Guthrie kind of did pass the torch symbolically to Bob Dylan. And Woody Guthrie, if you haven't heard his music, also very good. He's a legend, and this machine kills fascist guy. And yeah, he kind of passed the torch to Bob, and they did a good job of portraying that, if a little literal with the harmonica, but they did well.
Arlo Guthrie, Woody's son, says that, you know, that Bob did spend a ton of time with him in the hospital when he was sick and all
yeah.
That is true.
Wow. I wanted to mention one particular moment from Don't Look Back that I think is relevant to this conversation, just about sort of Bob, like, being either an asshole or, like, a liar, or just someone who, like, antagonizes people just to antagonize them. Towards the end of that documentary, where he's talking to the journalist being interviewed, and he's talking about how, like, you know, if he wanted to know, like, the truth about the world, he would not look at Time magazine or, like, Rolling Stone or one of those or whatever, right, because in his words, they have too much to lose by printing the truth. And yep. I heard that and I was sort of like, oh, okay, well, this was 1965. He, you know, what are we talking about? The civil rights movement, the death of JFK, Vietnam War, any of that stuff. And then the reporter asks him, well, do you have an example of that? What
I
truth?
Had the same reaction to this.
And Bob goes, Well, like,
truth.
Like a tramp throwing up into the gutter.
Yeah, exactly. I was, well, you know what? They didn't have the internet.
Like, he's a liar.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, he didn't really have a good answer for that. But it's funny because as I was watching that, I was like, yeah, you tell him. And then he was like, hey, you just, you know, put the pictures together. You don't do that. And I was like, ah,
kind of close.
Yeah,
so close.
It's like you're so close. You're in the right ballpark.
But, yeah, but you know. He's not here to do that. You know,
no, that's what of I'm course saying. Not. Of
and,
course,
you know, and that also made me realize, like, too. It's like he's not lying that he just does it to entertain. I think that is, I think, true. I think he just writes them because he can, and that's what the songs that come out of his brain sound like. So, like, I don't, yeah. You know, that's why he also says he doesn't understand it. He doesn't get why people love him the way they do. He doesn't like it. I completely believe him on all that. I think that's just. I don't think that you can really choose the music that you write. I honestly, if you're gonna do it, I think it kind of is just whatever comes out of you is what you write, and so that's how he writes his songs. He doesn't appreciate that it's received the way that it is,
right?
So,
and he's actively been trying to lose any fan base he has since 1963. You know,
that's
so
not gonna happen, yeah.
Like it's unsurprising.
It just makes people love him more. So,
like,
you know.
The moment in the movie where I don't remember if this is in Don't Look Back. I haven't seen Don't Look Back in so long, but they portray it in a complete unknown at the Newport Folk Festival, where someone in the audience yells Judas, and he says, "I don't believe you.
I don't believe you."
And then turns to the band and says, "Play it fucking loud." That didn't happen at Newport. Again, we don't need to like fact check everything around the movie, but that is pretty revealing. He is just there to needle the audience in some ways.
My guitar broke. I gotta go talk to
right
the
exactly
guy
that
there.
Scene as well.
It could have been sung, June.
Yeah, you know, he and again, these are not great personality traits in a friend, and these are not things.
No,
that
but
you
it's
should,
exactly
like,
what you want out of your rock star.
Yeah, but if you're Bob Dylan and you write music and sing like Bob Dylan, you can get away with these things, and they add to your mystique. So
exactly.
Do you guys have any final thoughts on this film before we wrap up for the week?
I think that's probably it. I just, you know, go see it. Go listen to some Bob Dylan music. Listen to some good stuff from the 60s. A lot of it is still very prescient. You know, listen to some Joan Baez, Phil Oakes if you want to, if that's more your speed. But all of that, I think, is I'm a huge proponent of just simple instrumentation and a nice written song as being an important part of your musical diet. So go do that.
Well, I just wanted to say James Mangold, who directed this, also directed Walk the Line, which you talked about. And I almost said Walk Hard, which is the parody.
I was
Walk
just going to mention that.
Go also watch Walk Hard.
Yes. But
haven't seen Walk Hard, go watch it.
But yeah, this is, to me, the best musical portrayal. I'm also a big Johnny Cash fan, not as big as Bob Dylan, but when you watch Walk the Line, you can feel like Joaquin Phoenix is Johnny Cash, and it's the same thing here. And James Mangold does such a great job with these musical biopics, and I hope that he maybe has a couple more in him, because they're just such a treat to watch and turn a new audience onto these legendary American artists.
Thoroughly watchable movie, I thought, too. Like, this is, like, entertaining. It's not the most cinematic thing beyond just, like, atmosphere.
No, and it's not, it doesn't
but
push
it's
any
very
boundary.
Entertaining. Very
it's
entertaining.
It's a pretty safe movie, but it's very entertaining.
I was going to say that I think that James Mangold deserves a lot of credit for taking Walk Hard on the chin. I mean, I know that we've all seen that. We all think that's a very funny movie with pretty pointed commentary about great man biopics that are
paid for drugs.
That are much worse than this one. If you don't know what that is, it's a parody of a music biopic starring John C. Reilly as a fake artist named Dewey Cox, who has many different like eras of his career and sounds that try to line up with where music was. And within the movie, he meets many like real artists, does LSD with the Beatles, but like ultimately, it's a hilarious movie and it pokes a lot of fun at the sort of paint by numbers storytelling that this movie I think leans into. But you know, like you said, Morg, we like the numbers so much and they execute it very well that, you know, I think that's fine. It doesn't really have any of the like winking name drops that I think we're sort of used to, where it's like, "What's your name, kid?" "Presley, Elvis Presley." And it's like, okay, great.
There is
the
"I'm Al Cooper," which that was like a little on the nose. Sure. Like, you know, how are you? You have to tell people.
Well, the Al Cooper thing, just real quick, is, you know, I don't think you would recognize that unless you're a big Bob Dylan head. But yeah, he was quite famously the organist on like Rolling Stone, who plays that amazing organ part. And was just like they show in the movie, just someone who kind of walked into the studio expecting to play drums. And
I hate the modern world. I like how cool that was.
Right, and ended up
seems
playing,
like it was pretty easy.
Ended up playing,
parents, like, go give them your resume.
Right, ended up playing the most iconic organ part in the history of music.
It's quite something.
But yeah, it's that is all very good, and I understand like the criticisms of this movie are you didn't show it's not like the Jim Morrison biopic where they show him, you know, involved in a lot of illicit activities. And, you know, sure. It's, like we said, a very safe movie. But there's not a ton of that to show with Bob Dylan.
I don't like, think that's, I mean, also at this era, I don't think he was doing
things. I mean, he may have been, but it's like, so what? Like, what does that do for me to right. see him, like, smoking weed in the movie? Like, oh, who gives a shit? It's just, yeah, the criticism is, oh, it's a safe biopic. They don't show, you know, some of his downsides. But I would argue they show you exactly what Bob Dylan has been trying to show you for years.
And what he is more than, you know, what smoking weed would present him as.
Right. Yeah. And I think that you just have to kind of take this for what it is. And I think it was really well executed. And great actors, too. Incredible performances. And Timothée Chalamet's singing was really, really good, shockingly. So, yeah.
That was a point I wanted to make, too. Every biopic from now on, no more piped-in studio cuts. I want actors singing live to camera from now on. If you're going to do it, that's how you have to do it.
I completely agree.
Yeah. I will not watch it if it's piped-in studio cuts of the real people. Because I don't care. Now you're not doing anything. Now you're making a music video. I don't want to watch it.
Right, yeah, Joaquin Phoenix wrote the blueprint when he sang all of Johnny Cash's songs, and everyone should be following that.
Rami Malek can pound sand.
Right.
He can.
Yeah, exactly. You want to talk about a safe biopic? You can talk about that one.
How about
Bohemian Rhapsody, which is enjoyable, but is also not well, like,
I hate
like
that
this.
Movie.
Still haven't seen it.
Don't need to. It sucks.
It's fine to watch on an airplane, which is where I watched it. Yeah, but it also is one of those movies where it's very evident that none of the actors were ever in the same room, is what it really shouted to me, because there's a lot of, the way it's shot is like not great. It's
fine.
I remember
the whole cutting thing, the equal time.
It gives me a fucking headache. There's a cut every half a second.
Right. But compared to that, this looks like fucking, you know, Citizen Kane. So,
and that's why I think that like Walk Hard is so successful, because a number of these great man musician biopics can be very similar and often dull. And maybe that is more because of James Mangold's like imitators than because of him. So I think making this is like a big time show of confidence that he let such a popular and successful like send up of his movie sort of roll off his back and not really shy away from doing something that he knew would be successful. So yeah, I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. You know, he's not just necessarily making like Oscar bait. I think he's kind of earned the reputation of being like your dad's favorite director, because if you look at his filmography, it seems like that's explicitly what he's trying to do, because like his biggest movies are about Johnny Cash, Bob Dylan, a gritty Wolverine movie that was so popular.
Logan is great. That's a fantastic movie.
He made a movie about race cars with Ford versus Ferrari.
Yep.
He made an Indiana Jones movie. He did a Western with Russell Crowe and Christian Bale. And then do you guys remember Night and Day with Tom Cruise from 2010? That was my favorite movie when I was like 11.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Dads, if you're listening to this podcast, go watch James Mangold's entire filmography.
I mean, they're just, you know, your standard biopics. And it's kind of something I've always been interested in, is these biopics that depict history and things that really happened, because it's the same reason I'm interested in shit like theme parks and, like, reality TV, is, like, this idea of, like, reality slightly off-kilter presented as reality. That's kind of a deep thought for an hour and 40 minutes into this podcast. Yeah, it's just, like, something I've always been interested in and something I think this movie does really well. So, yeah, check it out. Two thumbs up is my review.
Absolutely. Morgan, I mean, I was super surprised to see the 5-star rating for you. Brody, do you have a score for this movie?
I would also give it 5 stars. Maybe, you know, I'd give it like a 9 out of 10, I'd say.
Okay. Well, that would be 4.5
stars.
Just because
it is very enjoyable, as I said, and I like the subject matter. I like when actors sing. I appreciate all that.
I would go with, I think, 3.5 stars for me personally, but that still means that I enjoyed it quite a bit and would absolutely recommend it to any audience member or podcast listener who has not seen it yet. Especially if you care even a little bit about Bob Dylan, you will love this movie. It allows you to listen to his music for 2 hours, and there aren't many better experiences than that. And if you don't like Dylan, reevaluate.
You can hate
try
him.
Again.
No, he's also very hateable in this, so you can hate him if you want.
Oh, you can hate him, but fine. If you don't like his music, then reevaluate.
That's true. Leaving Timmy did lose to my guy Sebastian Stan at the Golden Globes for this, though, so I do get to write
He sure
that.
Did. He absolutely did. I think I'm pretty comfortable leaving it there for the week.
Absolutely.
If you have not heard yet about the Mudville Patreon, you can go check that out at patreon.com/Mudville. Access all of our back catalog of episodes, some written work, some prospect rankings. I have a first-year player draft list in the works right now for some of you fantasy baseball players looking at the most recent draft class that has been in the works for a while. Should be up by the end of the month. We've got a lot coming this week. Tony and I wanted to do our best first watches of the year this past week, but he did get sick, unfortunately, so we have had to reschedule that for next week, sort of why there's been a bit of a hiatus from us over the past couple weeks. But we've got that episode coming out, our top 10 movies of 2024 by the end of the month, and back to weekly scheduled releases from us on the Mudville main feed now that Brody is back from his adventures he was on towards the start of the year. So very excited to be moving forward with a bunch of fun stuff on the pod.
Well, I gotcha. Lots of stuff to talk about in New York sports if we want to go down that road again soon. So
yeah, sure. We could figure that out. And yeah, and thanks for having me on, fellas.
Thanks for being here.
Welcome back.
Yeah, you could find me places at Morgue of the Flies, like Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram, like the novel Lore of the Flies, Twitter. But with Morgue. I'm back on for I came back on during the college football bowl season just because it's more sports active than Blue Sky, but I'll probably drop off after football season ends because it frustrates me. But yeah, you can find me there. I'll probably be back with these guys towards the more towards the start of baseball season to talk about that. But been fun. Thanks, fellas.
I have been one of your hosts, Nolan Rabon.
I've been your other host, Brody Staub.
And this has been the Mudville Podcast. Thank you for listening, and we will see you all next week.
I'm tuned a note low, half a note low.
Okay.
This is George Washington.
Go away from my window. Leave at your own chosen speed. There's nothing in here moving, and anyway I'm not alone. You say you're looking for someone who'll pick you up each time you fall, to gather flowers for you constantly, and to come each time you call. A lover for your life and nothing more, but it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe.